It's March 2nd, and we are in Yirmiyahu Perek Lamed Dalet. Tonight is also Rosh Chodesh Adar Beis. And the Perek tonight is also the Haftorah for Parshas Mishpatim. It doesn't begin from the beginning of the Perek, it begins a few psukim into the Perek. But this we read this a little while ago for the Haftorah. So the pasuk says, "Hadavar asher haya al Yirmiyahu meis Hashem." The word that came to Yirmiyahu from Hashem, "Unevuchadrezzar melech Bavel v'chol chelo," and Nebuchadrezzar, the king of Bavel, and his entire army, "V'chol mamlechos eretz memsheles yado," and all the kingdoms that were under his control, "V'chol ha'amim," and all the nations, "Nilchamim al Yerushalayim ve'al kol areha," were waging war against Yerushalayim and all the cities around Yerushalayim. Lamar, so Hashem's word was saying. So there's overwhelming odds here against the Jews. They are not going, not without a miracle, they're not going to win this war. They're under siege. It's towards the very, very end of Tzidkiyahu's reign, and Hashem's word comes to Yirmiyahu. Komar Hashem Elokei Yisrael, so says Hashem, the God of Yisrael, Haloch ve'amarta al Tzidkiyahu melech Yehuda. Go and speak to Tzidkiyahu, the king of Yehuda. V'amartin lovin, you shall say to him, Komar Hashem, so says Hashem, Hinei nosenes soir hazos biyar melech Bavel, behold, I am giving this city over into the hands of the king of Bavel, usirafa ba'esh, and he will burn it in fire. You're not going to win this war, you're going to lose, the city is going to get burned down. Ve'ata lo simalet miyado, and you, Tzidkiyahu, will not escape him. Ki tafos ti tafes, you will be caught. Uviyado tinasen, you will be given over into his hands. Veinecha, and your eyes, as ene melech bavel tirena, you will see the eyes of the king of Bavel. He will look you in the eye. Ufiu es picha yedaber, and his mouth will speak directly to your mouth. Uvavel tavo, and you will be brought to Bavel. Tzidkiyahu is being brought to Bavel. He will be brought to Bavel 11 years after the previous Golus of Yechaniah. Yechaniah is already in Bavel in a dungeon. Tzidkiyahu will also be in a dungeon in Bavel after he is captured. We will learn that story later, the eventual destruction of Yerushalayim and the capture of Tzidkiyahu. So that here, that is being predicted. This is important because Tzidkiyahu has an escape route out of Yerushalayim, a hidden escape route out of Yerushalayim, and Hashem is making it clear to Tzidkiyahu, it's not going to help, you are going to get caught. Ach shma dvar Hashem Tzidkiyahu melech Yehuda. However, hear the word of Hashem Tzidkiyahu, the king of Yehuda. Komar Hashem alecha, so says Hashem about you, lo samus becharev, you will not be killed by this sword. So you will not be executed, even though you will be caught. Bishalom tamus, you will die in peace. Uvemisrafos avosecha hamalachim harishonim, and in the burnings of your ancestors, the kings, the earlier kings, asher hayu lufanecha, that came before you, kein yisrafulach, so too they will burn for you. Vahay adon yispedulach, and they will eulogize you by saying, Hay adon, woe to us, we've lost the master. We've lost the great king. Ki davar ani dibarti num Hashem, for I have spoken this thing, says Hashem. So this pasuk is saying to Tzidkiyahu that even though he is going to get caught, but he will still die in peace, which needs explanation. What does it mean he's going to die in peace? If he's going to get caught and he's going to be put in a dungeon, what does it mean he's going to die in peace? Then they're going to burn on your behalf the same way that your ancestors, they burned on their behalf. So what is this burning? Right? What does that mean exactly? We're going to talk about that at length. What is that burning? And here you have an explicit mention of a eulogy of that they will be maspid you. They will say a eulogy about you. They will mourn your loss, which brings up the question of eulogies, as I mentioned in my email to you about this shir. This is not the first place eulogies are mentioned. We have eulogies mentioned in the Chumash itself. But it does bring up the point about a hesped, about a eulogy, and we have to talk about that. So this is the message, though, that Yirmiyahu is told to give to Tzidkiyahu. Pasuk Vav, verse 6, Vayidaber Yirmiyahu anavi al Tzidkiyahu melech Yehuda, eis kol advarim ha'elav Yerushalayim. So Yirmiyahu, the Navi, told Tzidkiyahu, the king of Yehuda, all these words in Yerushalayim. V'chel melech Bavel nilchamim al Yerushalayim, and the army of the king of Bavel was waging war against Yerushalayim, v'al kol arei Yehuda hano saros, and all the cities of Yehuda that were remaining, which are the cities of El Lachish v'al Azeka, those are two of the cities that remained, ki hinei nisharu ba'arei Yehuda arei mivtzar, because there were some fortified cities still remaining in Yehuda that were holding out, and they were also under siege. Okay. So that's the backdrop. Now here, we begin the part that is the Haftorah for Parashas Mishpatim. Parashas Mishpatim begins, Ve'ela Mishpatim Asher Tasim Lifneihem. These are the laws that you shall place before them. And there's a whole bunch of laws mentioned in Parashas Mishpatim. Parashas Mishpatim is full of various halachos, laws, particularly monetary law, that involve a Beis Din. But the very first mitzvah mentioned in Parashas Mishpatim after that introduction is Ki Sikne Eved Ivri, when you will purchase a Jewish slave, Sheish Shanim Yavod, he'll work for 6 years, Uvashavi Seitzel Achav Shechinam, and in the 7th year, he goes out for free, without any payment. So, this Haftorah speaks, this Perek of Yirmiyahu speaks to that mitzvah, as it says now in Pasuk Ches, verse 8. Hadavar asher hayah el Yirmiyahu me'eis Hashem, the word that came to Yirmiyahu from Hashem, acharei keros hamelech Tzidkiyahu bris, after the king Tzidkiyahu had cut a covenant, as kol ha'am asher b'Yushalayim, with all the nation that was in Yushalayim, likro lahem diror, to call for themselves freedom, to allow their slaves to go free. Tzidkiyahu had gathered the people together, and he had given them a strong message that they must keep the law of the Torah to allow their Jewish slaves to go free after 6 years. And they agreed, and they made a covenant about that, the king and the people, that they would keep this halacha. Apparently, this was a big challenge for people, that they weren't keeping this halacha, and Tzidkiyahu made it a point towards the end of his reign, prior to the city being ready to crumble. He made it a point to gather the people and insist that they keep this halacha. Pasuk Tes, verse 9, one halacha, lishalach ish es avdov ish es shivchaso, for each person to send away their slave and their maid, ha'ivri vo'ivriya, Jewish male or Jewish female, chavshim, let them go free. Levilti avad bam, that biyudi achihu ish, that no Jew should work a fellow Jew. No Jew should subjugate a fellow Jew. So he made this bris, this covenant with them. Now there's a different rule for a male slave and a female slave, a Jewish male slave and a Jewish female slave. The Jewish males, yes.
Excuse me. Does the 6 years after which the slave goes free, does that have to do with the,
with the Yovel? No, it has nothing to do with the Shemitah year. No. The Shemitah year is not relevant to slavery. The Yovel year is, we'll discuss that later on. But the Shemitah year has nothing to do with it. The Shemitah year does not affect it in any way. So, at least not in the ways that we're talking about now. So, a male slave, a male Jewish slave, works for 6 years and goes free after the 6 years, with the option of extending that slavery until Yovel. Yovel is every 50 years, but it's not that he has the option to work for 50 years. It depends when Yovel comes. So if the sixth year, the end of his sixth year is 4 years before Yovel, he has the option of going until Yovel, which is another 4 years. The way he would do that would be to become a nirtza, which would be to have his ear pierced, and in so doing he would then be a slave until Yovel. That would be the the rule for a male Jewish slave. A female slave would work for 6 years, but she can only be a maid if she is under bas mitzvah. Meaning, once she has reached the age of bas mitzvah, she can no longer be sold into slavery to become a maid. It can't happen. It can only happen when she's under the age of bas mitzvah. If she is a slave for 6 years and she's not yet bas mitzvah, then she would go free at that point. That would be very unusual. It means she became a slave at a very, very young age. If during those 6 years she reaches the age of bas mitzvah, she goes free already at that point. There is no option for a female slave to stay until Yovel. It's only for a male slave. A female slave automatically goes free when she reaches bas mitzvah or 6 years, whichever comes first, and there is no option to go longer than that. In both cases, the case...
more basic question.
Yeah.
How does someone so young like that become a slave?
That would be a father selling her into slavery. Just like a father could marry off his daughter, he could sell her into slavery as well. It's a completely different setup for a female, because really what the Torah is setting up over there is the option for her master to marry her. It's really what the Torah is speaking to is a case of intense poverty, and the father has no way of feeding his children, and so someone is willing to take her into his family with the option of possibly marrying her later on, just like a father could marry her off, but the person doesn't want to marry her right now, and therefore she works. Now, understandably, a 6-year-old, a 7-year-old is not going to work that hard. So she's going to do what a 6 or 7-year-old daughter would do, which is, you know, whatever she's going to do. She'll set the table, she'll clear off the table, she'll sweep the floor, you know, whatever it is that she's going to do that is age appropriate. But the goal is that it turn into marriage.
Is that when they could have many wives?
That's when they could have many wives, right. Right. But that's the ultimate goal of that type of arrangement. The Torah never allows, it's just a good point to be aware of, the Torah never allows a woman to, a Jewish woman to be under the control of a man who is neither her father nor her husband. That is something which the Torah never allows to happen. Because that's a ticket for promiscuity. One way or the other. Either he'll take advantage of her, or she will use this to get what she wants out of him. Either way, it causes promiscuity. And therefore the Torah doesn't allow that type of arrangement, that type of setup. The only setup there can be is a father who is in charge of his children, or a husband and his wife. And therefore, this setup is only allowed because it's a prelude to marriage. In which case, it avoids promiscuity, because if that's what the owner, the master, whatever you want to call it, if that's what he is interested in, he'll marry her. There's no reason for it to be promiscuous. So that's the way it goes. Now, I'm just saying this as a sidebar, just to be aware of this. This is the main issue with why we do not allow women in the army. It is not for any other reasons that you may have seen or thought about. This is the main reason. Because when you put someone in the army, you can't quit. A job, you can always quit. You can walk away from. So you can be an employee, a woman can be an employee of a male employer, because she can always walk away. And he could always fire her. So that avoids the larger issue of promiscuity. But in an army setting, it's not employment, and the soldiers have no choice; they must be there, and that leads to promiscuity. And that is what goes on. That promiscuity goes on in every army where you have males and females. That goes on regularly. It's rampant. Because either someone's taking advantage, or someone is using this as a way of getting what they want. Either way, it causes promiscuity. So it's a terrible, terrible thing, and that's why, that is the main reason why it is no good, which is also why we reject the civil service that they offer in Eretz Yisrael as well. Shirut Lumit. That's why we reject that as well. Because that's also something you can't quit, can't walk away from. and that causes the same problems as the army. So now in theory you can have a chain of command that's all women, just have a women's army. That's straight, you know, from private to general, and it's all women. You could theoretically have that, and that would avoid this problem. But then you're creating a division that doesn't have any men in it, which you have to question whether that is the best way to defend your country.
You
so,
Shirut-Lumi like that.
Right, you could do Shirut-Lumi like that. Right. You could do Shirut-Lumi like that. Right, right. Okay, but that is a sidebar. At any rate, the freedom that we're talking about over here that they weren't doing for the male slaves and the female slaves, it's a different system, but either way, they were not keeping the halacha of letting the slaves go when they were supposed to let them go. And now he made this covenant with them that they would. Now this is backtracking. This is not at this point when Yirmiyahu is speaking to Ezekiel. We're going back a couple of years when this deal was made. But now, as we'll see, Pasuk Yud, verse 10, so after they made this, after Ezekiel laid down the law, this is what has to happen. Vayishmu chol hasarim v'chol ha'am, and all of the leaders and all the people, they listened, ashabo v'abris, that they came into that covenant, l'shalach ishes avdo v'ishes shivchas chavshim, to send away their slaves, their male slaves and female slaves, free, l'vilti'a, avod bam od, that they should not subjugate them anymore. Vayishmu, and they listened. Vayishalechu, they sent them away. But then, pasuk Yudal, verse 11. Vayashuvu achareichen, they came back afterwards. Vayashivu esavodim vesashvachos, they brought back their slaves and their maids. Asher shilchu chavshim, that they had sent away for free. Vayich bishum laavodim lishvachos, and they subjugated them as slaves and as maids. They went back and took back. They went back on their word. They had originally agreed to Tzidkio to listen, and then they went back and took back their slaves and their maids. So this was therefore a double transgression, because first they were going against the Torah to begin with, but then they finally listened, and then they went back and did it again. And they went back and took them. So first of all, you see that Tzidkio did not have control over the people. That we knew already, that he was dealing with a very, very thin, he was walking on very, very thin ice. His leadership was very, very tenuous to begin with. He made it a point, they listened, but then they turned around and took them back. Also, you see that the slaves and the maids did not really have social standing to be protected. Meaning, once they walked away, they were given freedom, but when their masters came back and insisted or demanded or coerced them back into slavery, they were coerced. They were unable to resist. So there, you don't have a police force that is defending the weak, or that is taking care of the people who are defenseless. There, you have a social system in which the might makes right. The strong ones are, or the powerful ones are, taking advantage of everybody else.
I thought when you put a Jewish slave free, you had to give him a lot of wealth.
Yes.
You had to give him stuff.
Yeah, the question is, when you send a Jewish slave free, you're supposed to give them wealth, give them money. You're supposed to. I don't know if they did that or not. That's a good question. I don't know if they did or didn't. Either way, it didn't help if they did. Yes?
But my president, was taking out thinking that if they did this, if it's sort of the halacha, it might be some scar for them.
That is correct.
It won't be as bad for them?
Yes, he was doing this to try to stave off the destruction, which means that of all the averus they were doing, he zeroed in on this one, which I don't know if we would have thought of that. Maybe we would have thought of Shabbos or Kashrus or something like that. So he zeroed in on this specific halacha. So we have to talk about that, why this one. Now, maybe he felt that this was the one that he could make happen, but we'll see that there's a little bit more to it than just that.
Wait. Who's the he there?
Tzidkiyahu. That's Tzidkiyahu, right? He made this the mitzvah that he's going to try to enforce. And he was sort of successful, but then they came back and they went against it. Pasuk Yud Beis, verse 12. Vayhi divar Hashem el Yirmiyahu meis Hashem lemar. The word came to Yirmiyahu from Hashem saying, Komar Hashem Elokei Yisrael. So says Hashem, the God of Yisrael. Anochi karati vris es avosechem biyom hotzi'i osam me'eretz Mitzrayim. I cut a covenant with your ancestors on the day I took them out of Mitzrayim. Mi beis avadim, from a house of slavery. That should tip us off. Lamar is saying, Mi keitz sheva shanim tishalchu ish es achiv ha'ivri. that after 7 years, each man should send away his Jewish brother, Asher Imachel Lecha, that was sold to you, Va'avadcha Sheish Shanim, and he worked for you for 6 years, V'shilachto Chavshi Me'imach, you shall send him for free from you, V'lo Shamu Avosechem Eilai, and your ancestors did not listen to me, V'lo Hitu Esaznam, they did not turn their ear, they did not bend their ear to listen to me. There is a contradiction in this pasuk, because first it says at the end of 7 years, and then it says they'll serve you for 6 years. What does 7 years mean? What that seems to be incorrect. So we will talk about that, Mirtz Hashem. Pasuk Tesvav, verse 15. Vatashuvu atem hayom, and you people, you that are alive now, you went back today. Vatasu es hayashar beinai, you did what was good in my eyes, straight in my eyes. Likro deror ish dereyehu, for each man to call freedom for his friend. Vatichrisu vris lefanai, and you cut a covenant before me. Babayis ashenikra shmi alav, in the house that my name was called upon it. We see now that the covenant that Tzidkiyahu made with the people was done in the Beis Hamikdash, and they agreed that they would send away the slaves. But then Hashem goes on, Vatashuvu, you returned, Vatichalalu es shemi, and you profaned my name. Vatashivu ish es avdo, v'ish es shivchaso, and each man took back their slave and their maid. Ashashilachtem chavshim linafsham, that you had sent them free for to be on their own. Vatichbishu osam, and you subjugated them, lios lachem la'avodim lishvachos, to be for you as slaves and maids. Lachain ka'amar Hashem, therefore so says Hashem. Atem lo shem atem elai. You did not listen to me, likro duror, to call freedom, ish li achiv, ish li re'ehu, each man for his brother and for his friend. Hinani kore lachem duror. So midah keneged midah, measure for measure. I am going to call you, for you, freedom. Nu'um Hashem, says Hashem. I am going to send you away free from me. You did not send the slaves and the maids free from you. Then I am going to send you free from me. But being free from me is not a good thing. You don't want to be free from me, because being free from me means El HaCherev, El HaDever, El HaRav, to the sword, to the plague, to the famine. And I will put you as trembling for all the kingdoms of the world, meaning people will see you and tremble. Look what happens to this nation. We don't want to be like this nation to get punished like they are. And I will place the people who are transgressing my covenant, that they did not establish the words of the covenant, that they cut before me, ha'egel asher karsu lishnayim, the calf that they cut in two, vayavru bein bisarav, and they cross between its parts. What does that remind you of? The bris bein abisarim of Avraham Avinu. There was a covenant that they cut. Chazal tell us, Rashi quotes it over here, they actually made a covenant to go back on their word that they had made with Yirmiyahu. The people said, this is unacceptable. We let our slaves and maids go free. Tzidkiyahu was making us do something which we didn't really want to do. And they got together, and you know how it is. You don't want to be the only one to go back and do something. So they made it, they got together, they created a group, and as a group they resolved to go against Hashem's word, go against the rules of Tzidkiyahu, and take their slaves and maids back. So it wasn't that one person went, they got together as a group, and they made a covenant, they walked between the two halves of a calf, and that was a way of solidifying this agreement, that was like a handshake, that they will now go back and take back their slaves and their maids.
So the first time they made a covenant with the king, and this time they're making a covenant just with each other.
That's right. The first one was a covenant with the king, now it's a covenant with each other.
And we don't know where the covenant with each other takes place.
Right, we don't know where it takes place. That's right. But it is a covenant. This is a common thing, as everybody knows, that when there is, when people want to do something and they're unsure, they're a little bit, they're unsure of what will be the public reaction, they get a group together. And when there's a group, then more things can be done that would not have been done otherwise.
The whole thing with the covenant with Hashem is that it can't be undone.
Right.
So the whole idea was, they, undo a covenant.
They went against it. The question is, how could they undo a covenant? The answer is they went against it. They did an Avera. That's why this is worse. See, until now they were doing an Avera, which is bad. All Averas are bad. But then they made a covenant that they would keep this one.
So they broke the covenant in addition to doing it.
Right. And that's why they broke the covenant. And therefore Hashem says, you profaned my name. You did a Chil Hashem. If this is worse, it's like you're slapping Hashem in the face. Like, forget it. We're not doing this anymore.
How many years is...
So it's not clear when the covenant was made with Tzidkiyahu and the people. It is clear. We haven't spoken about it yet. They made the covenant in the 7th year of Tzidkiyahu. So, and Tzidkiyahu rules for 11 years. They broke the covenant sometime later on. That's not exactly clear exactly when the breaking of the covenant happened. I think it was around the 9th year or so, right before Nebuchadnezzar comes and lays siege to the city. So it's somewhere in there that this happens. Pasuk Yud Tes, verse 19. Sari Yehuda v'sari Yushalayim, the leaders of Yehuda and Yushalayim, hasari sim v'akoanim, the officials and the Kohanim, v'cholam ha'aretz, all the nation, all the people, ha'ovrim bein b'sri ha'egel, that had gone between the parts of the calf. So Hashem says, what am I going to do to all of them? V'nasati osam be'aroi ve'hem, I will put them in the hands of their enemies, uvi'ad mevakshi nafsham, and in the hands of those who seek their souls. V'haisa nivlasam l'ma'achol, and their corpses will be as fodder, la'of ha'shamayim u'levamas ha'aretz, for the birds of the heaven and the beasts of the land. Ve'sidkiyahu melech Yehuda ve'sarav, and Tzidkiyahu, the king of Yehuda, and his leaders, his officers, etain v'yad o'ivehem, I will give over in the hands of their enemies, u'v'yad mevakshein afsham, and in the hands of those who are seeking their souls, u'v'yad chil melech bavel, and in the hands of the army of Bavel, the king of Bavel, ha'olim me'aleichem, that are leaving you right now. You'll recall that Nebuchadnezzar laid siege to Yerushalayim, and then there was word that the army of Paro, of Mitzrayim, were coming to wage war with Bavel. So that caused them to leave Yerushalayim. But we already learned that Yirmiyahu told the people, this is not going to last. That Hashem is going to have the Mitzrayim go back to Mitzrayim. You remember the story that they were in the water, they were on the boats, and they saw things floating. They said, oh, these are our ancestors who were drowned by the Jews. Why are we going to save the Jews? And they turned around and went back to Egypt. And then Nebuchadnezzar comes back to Yerushalayim. So here, Hashem says that even though it appears like Nebuchadnezzar is leaving, but he is going to come back, and when that happens, he's going to destroy the city. But Tzidkiyahu is not going to be killed. The first group, the ones that went back on the covenant, they're going to be killed. Tzidkiyahu will be given over to Nebuchadnezzar, but he will live, as we said before. And finally, Hinani mitzavenu Hashem, behold, I am commanding, v'ashivosim Elohir hazos, I'm going to bring them back, meaning I'm going to bring Nebuchadnezzar back to this city, v'nilchamu aleha, they will wage war against it, u'lechaduha, they will capture it, u'srafu avayish, they'll burn it in fire, v'esarei Yehuda etein shmama, in the cities of Yehuda I will make desolate, me'in yoshev, without anybody dwelling there. End of that nevuah, end of that discussion. So, we have a great deal to talk about over here. I'm going to talk about the slavery first, even though it's the second part of this parak. We had the first part was about Tzidkiyahu, but we'll go back to Tzidkiyahu in a moment. But I want to talk about the slavery first, because we have to deal with the chronology of how things are going, how the story worked. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech haolam shehakol nivra. The first question we have is, that we're going to deal with first, is back in Pasuk Yudal 14, where there's a mention of, at the end of 7 years, you'll send away your brother. But it's the end of 6 years, not the end of 7 years. Why 7 years? So this question is asked in the Gemara.
Isn't it on the 7th year that they
made this? It's the 7th year that they're supposed to be sent away, but this is at the end of 7 years, it says.
No, but isn't it the 7th year of Hizkiyahu's reign?
Yes, it's true. It's the 7th year of Hizkiyahu's reign. But Pasuk Yud Dalet is not talking about the years of his reign. It's talking about when they should send away their slaves. So it sounds like you keep the slaves for 7 years. So So the Gemara says that you send away a regular slave after 6 years, but a slave that chooses to become a nirtza, a slave that chooses to have his ear pierced, stays until the end of Yovel, which the shortest time that could be would be at the end of the 7th year. Now, as in theory, Yovel could be the year after his 6th year, and then he would get one more year of slavery if he chooses to have it. So when it says at the end of 7 years, it means in a case of a nirtza, a case of someone who had their ear pierced to stay until Yovel, then they're minimally going to be there till the end of the 7th year. Because if Yovel happened before the 6th year, they would have gone free already anyway. If Yovel, I forgot to mention this before, if Yovel comes, let's say, after 2 years of his slavery, meaning two of his 6 years, he goes free right away. Doesn't say the whole 6 years. But here, the minimum that someone who becomes a nirtza, someone who gets his ear pierced, the minimum they could be a slave, is one more year past the 6 years. That would be the 7th year. Which begs the question, was there Yovel at this time or not? Now, today we know we have Shemitah. Shemitah is this year. This is a Shemitah year in Eretz Yisrael, which will affect us really more next year than this year, because it takes time for the produce to be processed and come to be sold in the United States. Some of it is already here, but wine produced this year, things like that are going to be an issue for us. So there's Shemitah produce. This year is a Shemitah year. Those living in Eretz Yisrael have to deal with it right now. So this is a Shemitah year. You've not heard, though, of a Yovel year. Now, Yovel is the 50th year. Shemitah is every 7 years. Yovel is the 50th year. There's actually two opinions whether Yovel is the 49th year or the 50th year. In other words, does the 7th Shemitah year, 7 times 7 is 49, does the 7th Shemitah year double as Yovel, or is the year following the 7th Shemitah year Yovel? That is a machlokas in the Gemara. Either way, you've not heard of Yovel. The reason why you've not heard of Yovel today is because we don't have Yovel today. We only have Shemitah. Why do we not have Yovel today? Because in order to have Yovel, you have to have that, there's different opinions exactly how to say this, but you need to have most of the Jews living in Eretz Yisrael in order for there to be Yovel. Some say that there's more specifications than that. It's not just most of the Jews. It's that you have to have most of each shevet, most of each tribe in Eretz Yisrael. Today, that's impossible to ascertain. Even if you do a census of all Jews, which is going to be very difficult to do anyway, to really know how many Jews there are in the world. But even if you would do that, and you would arrive at the conclusion that most Jews live in Eretz Yisrael, 51% live in Eretz Yisrael, there's no way to know that there's most of each tribe in Eretz, so we don't know who's from which tribe anyway. In addition to that, living in Eretz Yisrael is also subject to debate what that means. Does a person living in Tel Aviv or Haifa, is that considered Eretz Yisrael for this purpose? Or do they need to be in and around Yerushalayim? Depends whether you deal with the boundaries from the first Beis HaMikdash or for the second Beis HaMikdash. So it's not so simple to make the claim that we can have Yovel today. So we do not have Yovel today. So the thing is that Yovel did not stop with the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. There was no Yovel in the second Beis HaMikdash, because the second Beis HaMikdash only had
the remnant,
right? Yovel did not stop at the end of the first Beis HaMikdash, because once the 10 tribes went into exile, you didn't have all the tribes in Eretz Yisrael. You didn't have the majority. So Yovel ended in the reign of Chizkiyahu, way back when Sanherib took the 10 tribes into exile. That's when Yovel ended. So for a long time already, there has not been Yovel in Eretz Yisrael in the days of Yirmiyahu. So then the Gemara says, why here does it mention the end of the 7th year, which we're saying refers to a slave who becomes a nirtza and stays until the end of Yovel? There is no Yovel anymore. So what is a mention of, why is this a mention of Yovel over here? Says the Gemara, because Yirmiyahu, in the days of Yoshiyahu, That would be Tzidkiyahu's father, who was a great tzaddik, you'll recall. In that time, Yirmiyahu went to where the 10 tribes were taken, and he was able to gather some people from each of the tribes and bring them back to Eretz Yisrael. And there was a period of time when Yoshiyahu ruled over all 12 tribes. And that continued until the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. So there was representation from all 12 tribes. Now, it's hard to say there was most of each of the 12 tribes, but that you would have had most of the Jews, perhaps, and you'd have representation from all the 12 tribes. Again, there's different opinions exactly what you need, what the criterion is for there to be Yovel. But you certainly need at least some of all the 12 tribes. So he had that. And therefore it was back in force. Not only was there Shemitah, but there also was Yovel at this time. So historically it's important to know that here we have a mention of Yovel, and the reason why that's possible is because some of the 12 tribes had been returned to Eretz Yisrael. Yeah.
It kind of sounded to me like the people hadn't been keeping the laws of setting the Jewish slave free. So at that point, there might have been people that were overdue to be set free.
Yeah, yeah.
So why weren't they set free already? Like, why wasn't there a penalty for having held on to them?
Yeah, the question is, why was there a penalty for having held on to the slaves longer? There's no mention of it. I don't know. It could be that all Tzidkiyahu was able to do was get them to let them go. That may have been
the future.
Yeah, that may have been the extent of what he was able to get them to do. I don't know. It's a good question. So,
are you saying that for that 1 year, then they would pull all of those people into the city? Or just the Yovel to happen? That they would pull them in that year? Or that they were actually move them in and they were living there for some time?
I'm not sure. The question is, well, I'm not sure what the question is.
To have the percentage for all the tribes in the city.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah, no.
Import them for the year?
Right, I got it. No, the question was, what does it mean to have the percentage of the people? Where were they? It doesn't have to be in the city, in Eretz Yisrael. Not in Yerushalayim. I was just excluding possibly today's borders of Eretz Yisrael versus the borders of the second Beis HaMikdash. Which might be, when you go to Eretz Yisrael and you talk about where are the biblical borders of Eretz Yisrael, so there's different ways of defining that. There's what was promised to Avraham Avinu, there was the borders under Shlomo HaMelech, and then there's the borders under the second Beis HaMikdash. There were different borders. So when we talk about having most of the Jews in Eretz Yisrael to reinstate Yovel, it might mean most of the Jews in the second Beis HaMikdash borders, which are much smaller than the first Beis HaMikdash borders. But they don't all have to be in Yerushalayim. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, but they would have to import them just for the year, or they were people who already lived there?
They would have to be there. Question is, when do they have to be there? They have to be there the whole time. They have to be there from the beginning of the Yovel cycle for the entire 50 years.
Oh, for the entire 50 years.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. So here we have a reference to at least a representation of each of the tribes being in Eretz Yisrael at this time. And having been there, like was just pointed out, having been there from the time of Yoshiyahu, that the king who had ruled before, who had been killed at this point, it would have been 20 years before this point. So then, as I mentioned, we know that when was this bris done? When was this covenant done? It was done in the 7th year of Tzidkiyahu. So how do we know that? So we know that because there is a pasuk in Yechezkel. Some of you may remember learning Yechezkel. We learned Yechezkel. We started Yechezkel 15 years ago, a little more than 15 years ago, and we finished it, I don't know, maybe 2-3 years after that. So, in Yechezkel, it took us 5 years to learn Yechezkel? Wow, okay. Alright. It doesn't take 5 years to catch up online, but it took a long time to learn that saber, right? Anyway, so, Yechezkel There is a story in Yechezkel where some people come to Yechezkel in the seventh year of his Golus, of his exile. Now Yechezkel went into Golus, into exile with Yechaniah, which is when Tzidkiyahu became king. So the seventh year of Yechezkel's exile is the seventh year of Tzidkiyahu's reign. And they came and they said to Yechezkel, what's the law if a Kohen sells his slave? The rule is a slave of a Kohen can eat truma. That's the law. Not a Jewish slave, actually, but a non-Jewish slave of a Kohen can eat truma. That's the law.
But a
non-Jewish slave owned by a Kohen can eat truma. What's the law if the Kohen sells that slave? Could he still eat truma? Now the answer is no, but that's obvious. But the reason why they were asking that is because they were trying to imply that since Hashem has sold us, meaning he sent us into exile, we are no longer required to keep the Torah. Because just like the Kohen's slave who is sold away from the Kohen no longer has the status of Kohen, meaning while he was owned by the Kohen, he could eat truma, but now he no longer has the status of Kohen, so too, we have been sold into exile. We're no longer subjects of Hashem, and therefore we don't have to keep the Torah anymore. That was what they were implying to Yechezkel. This, the Gemara links, the Medrash links that story and this story over here, that there is a discussion of slavery going on in the Jewish people, because the Jewish people are realizing that some of them have been taken into exile. Exile is another way of saying slavery. Not slavery in the sense like in Egypt, but they were basically taken away from their independence, from their autonomy, and now they're living in a foreign land, forced to live as the government of Bavel wants them to live. And they do not have autonomy anymore. And therefore, there's a discussion of slavery going on. The people who were in Bavel with Yechezkel, some of them anyway, were implying that perhaps they no longer have to keep the Torah. In Eretz Yisrael, Tzidkiyahu was dealing with the pulse of the people. They know what's happened to their brethren who are now in Bavel. They're still in Eretz Yisrael. They know what kind of danger lurks, that if they're taken into exile, they too will lose their autonomy. They don't want to lose their autonomy. And therefore, your Tzidkiyahu is able to tap into that fear and to make it a point and say, look, if you don't want to lose your autonomy, you want to be able to remain independent, then you at least have to keep the part of the Torah that discusses who should be independent. If you have slaves and you have maids that are supposed to be let free and they're supposed to be independent and you're holding on to them, how can you expect Hashem to make you independent and to allow you to keep your autonomy? And therefore he was able to strike a chord, and he was able to get people who were otherwise not really keeping the Torah properly to galvanize them that they should now do something right. And they did resolve to do this correctly. They were in fear. They wanted to stay independent. And this was something which would have been a zechus, it would have been a merit, to perhaps keep their independence. This worked for a short time. But they then relapsed. They, to give up their slaves and their maids, think about it, if you have everything is being done for you, and you're living essentially in luxury because everything is being done for you, and then suddenly you don't have that anymore. So it's something which they didn't enjoy. That we're talking about the most powerful people, the wealthiest, most powerful people of the country, And they didn't want to live any other way. And after a short time, again, it's not clear exactly how much time, they relapsed and they took the slaves and maids back. And they coerced them back into service. And that was, therefore, a terrible Chilul Hashem. The fact that they used for their covenant to go against Hashem an egel, a calf, is not coincidental. Meaning that they really could have used any type of animal, but they used a calf. First of all, at the Bris Bein HaBesarim, with the covenant that Avraham Avinu made with Hashem, there were several animals. But the first animal mentioned is Egla. Kichali Egla Mishuleshes. Take from me an Egla, which is a calf. That was the first animal mentioned by Hashem. So they are clearly, it's not like a coincidence, they use a calf. They're clearly, they knew the Chumash. They're clearly saying, we are rejecting the Bris Bein HaBesarim. It's as if Avraham walked through the two halves in one direction, we're gonna walk out in the other direction. He went through this way, we're going the other way. We're going against that. We're not lining up with Hashem like Abraham did. We're going against Hashem. We are not doing this anymore. Forget it. And they were essentially slapping Hashem in the face, kiviyachol. The connection to the Egel Hazav, to the golden calf, must also connect to this. It is something to think about that there is some sort of a connection between a calf and a covenant. And the Jews in the Midbar who worshiped the golden calf were also breaking the covenant with Hashem really in the worst possible way there as well. So that is what's happening over here in this whole discussion of slavery. Now,
I'm sorry.
Yes. Yeah, sure.
Why didn't they just take new slaves? Things are bad in the city. They could have found other people to work for them. Why did they have to go back to these people?
Questions, why didn't they take...
And then they wouldn't have broken the covenant.
Questions, why didn't they take new slaves? First of all, these were the ones who were the weakest link. That they needed to take people who were defenseless, who they could take and no one was protecting them. I imagine these were the ones. In addition, they probably already had most of the people as slaves. In other words, those who could be slaves were slaves. They weren't going to take someone who was able to support themselves. It would be someone who needed the money, who would end up being a slave. It was probably the same pool of people. Now, Nebuchadnezzar comes and lays siege to the city. And we have the drama where he's drawn away because of the Egyptians, but he's going to come back. But Hashem says to Yirmiyahu that you will not be killed. That you will not be killed. And in fact, he will not be killed. We're going to learn, as I said before, we will learn in detail about his capture later on. But he will be captured, and he will be taken to Golus, and he will be put in a dungeon in Bavel. But it said earlier that he's going to die in peace. So what does it mean he's going to die in peace? I'm just turning back to Pasuk. Hey, verse 5. B'shalom Thomas, you will die in peace. Why will he? What does it mean he's going to die in peace? So the Gemara says that, and we're going to see, it's not going to be pleasant for him at all, although he will live, but he's going to go through some very, very serious difficulties and pain and suffering. So, what does it mean he'll die in peace? The Gemara says he will outlive Nebuchadnezzar. He will remain in the dungeon. The rule in Bavel was that if Nebuchadnezzar put someone in the dungeon, they remain there until his death. Nebuchadnezzar ruled for 37 years. Those 37 years, in the 19th of his 37 years, is when he conquered, when he destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. So there was another 18 years after that, that Tzidkiyahu remained in the dungeon. Nebuchadnezzar will die on the 25th day of Adar that year. In the 26th day of Adar, his son, Evil Merudach, who will succeed him as king, will take the body of Nebuchadnezzar and drag it through the streets, which will be symbolic of all of his decrees are now null and void. And therefore, those who are in the dungeons come out of the dungeons, which include Tzidkiyahu. It also includes Yechaniah. Both of them will emerge from the dungeon. And then, on the 27th of Adar, the next day, Tzidkiyahu will die. So he will outlive Nebuchadnezzar. Now, even though he doesn't outlive him in any kind of wonderful, beautiful life, but there apparently is some satisfaction in having outlived his enemy, having outlived Nebuchadnezzar, and he will. And when that happens, because he outlives him, therefore the rest of this pasuk can happen. See, if he would have died in the dungeon, they would never have been able to eulogize him. They never would have been able to do anything, any kind of honor with his death, because he would have been a political prisoner who died. But here, he will have emerged from jail, and then he dies, and he will get a proper burial, which means they will eulogize him. They will burn for him. What does it mean they will burn for him? The Gemara tells us that it was standard practice. When a king would die, they would burn his personal effects, which means his clothing, his bed, the things that were specific to the king were burned. This was a sign of honor for the king. It's to say, no one else can use it. Once the king dies, no one else can use these things. They are burned. The Gemara says that it is permitted to do this even though it was a pagan practice. We can still do it today. Why? Because since it was done by our kings before it was a pagan practice, we're not learning from the pagans. We're learning from our kings. And therefore, when something was done by the Jews, not as a pagan practice, even though the pagans started doing it, it does not necessarily prohibit it. Now, sometimes we have things that are no longer done because they became pagan practice. But usually that has to do with ways of worshiping Hashem. So, for example, I will just mention this to you, but I don't want to get sidetracked with this. Just be aware that the minhag that many people have of having flowers on Shavuos, because of Har Sinai, that it flowered, that's not really the original minhag. The original minhag is a tree. Because that's really what was on Har Sinai. It wasn't flowers. It was vegetation. It wasn't like, I know they draw pictures of the flowers all over Har Sinai. It really was vegetation that happened. It was a desert, and it grew vegetation and trees. And there was a minhag to have a tree, or a shrub or something like that. That was the minhag. But that became batal when it became something that was done by the people around us. So we don't do things like that. But here, this is for the honor of the king. This is not a way of worshiping Hashem, and therefore we do it even though it became a pagan practice, because it is something that was done. We're not learning from them, we're learning from what happened over here, as you see with Tzidkiyahu. The Gemara discusses, is a hesped, is a eulogy, is it for the honor of the person who passed away, or is it for the honor of the people who are left behind, meaning for the mourners? Why do we say a eulogy? For whom is the eulogy? Is it somehow helping the deceased, or is it helping those who remain behind? You can argue it's both, but the Gemara, right, you can argue it's both, but the Gemara discusses, is it one or the other? The Gemara attempts to prove from here that clearly it's for the deceased, because since the Tzidkiyahu is told, don't worry, they will eulogize you, evidently it's important to Tzidkiyahu that he is eulogized. So it must be, it's helpful to the one who passed away. But the Gemara says it's not necessarily true. It might be true, but it's not necessarily true, because you could also understand that Tzidkiyahu is being told, don't worry, you will be treated like anybody else who dies, and they will say a eulogy for you for their behalf. Not for your behalf, but for their behalf, but you will still have a eulogy. In other words, you won't be a political prisoner who dies in prison, rather they will have a chance to say a eulogy to you. It is important, though, to be aware, and as was just mentioned, that it probably is both, that we know that the deceased does benefit from the eulogy, because the eulogy enables the people to remember the good of the one who passed away, and when people remember the good and behave better because of the person who passed away, then that is a zechus, that's a merit to the deceased. And then, of course, also, it is very helpful to the people left behind that to have the positive memories and the positive discussion of the one who passed away.
Right.
Yeah,
so if someone dies on a chag,
yes,
aliyah is supposed to be, it's an aliyah from the neshama, but you're not allowed to do chesbidim during that time.
Yes.
So,
yeah,
how can it be an aliyah and something good?
It's a good question.
It's
a good question. I can't. The question is, what happens when a person dies at a time when you can't do a eulogy, which is like on a yontif or in Chodesh Nisan, Rosh Chodesh? Right. It's a good question. That's a good question. My grandfather's yard site is tonight, and there was no hesped because
it
was Rosh Chodesh. Right. Yes. Right. It's a good question. Now the the Gemara says that Tzidkiyahu here, so he's being told all these things, and that he was, again, he's going to outlive Nebuchadnezzar, and there will be shalom for him in that way, and that they will burn on his behalf. There's a few more points. We're really out of time. I want to mention one thing, though, which is just a fascinating connection. The Medrash says, the Medrash is discussing the term chanata. Chanata is found with Yaakov Avinu, that when he died, that Yosef commanded vayachantu harofim es Yisrael.
Embalmed.
Thank you. Embalmed. Yaakov Avinu. Now, it doesn't mean they mummified him the way that the Egyptians used to do, because they didn't take out any organs, but they used various
treatments,
right, to preserve the body. That's what they did. So the term there is vayachantu. That's the verb chanata. So the Medrash is bothered by what does that word mean? So normally that word means to ripen. And we find that word with the Gemara tells us that the Tu B'Shvat, that date on the calendar, differentiates between the fruits of that year and the previous year. And it has to do with whether there was a Chanata before Tu B'Shvat or after Tu B'Shvat. When did the fruit begin to ripen? Before Tu B'Shvat or after Tu B'Shvat? That's where that cutoff line is on the calendar for fruits to determine what year the fruit is from. So the Medrash says, how do you connect ripening a fruit to embalming a body? What does one thing do with the other? So this is a fascinating thing which you can think about, which is the language in Hebrew for the ripening of a fruit is bishul, is cooking. It doesn't literally mean to cook, but when a fruit is ripe, the Gemara calls it its nisbashel, bishul. It's cooked, which means not cooked from fire. It means the sun has acted upon it to a point where now it's juicy and ripe and ready to eat. That's called bishul. So the Medrash says that in the embalming process, what they have to do is they have to cook these various potions or treatments, whatever they're going to put on the body. They have to take the herbs, whatever they're using, and they cook them. And they create a paste or a lotion, and then they put that on the body. And that preserves the body. So the Medrash says that, how do we know that that's how they make the various things that are used for embalming? Because it says here, the burnings that they'll burn for you, says the Medrash, a second meaning, rather than burning his items, it means to burn those treatments that are going to be needed, cook those treatments that are going to be needed to put on the body to embalm the body, like it was done for Yaakov Avinu. So the Medrash says, since both processes require a cooking, whether it's the cooking, the Medrash says, the cooking of the sun or the cooking of fire. Either way, it doesn't matter whether it's the sun, quote unquote, cooking the fruit, making the fruit ripe, or the fire cooking the herbs to make the treatments, but that is the connection between the two. And that's why the word chanata is used in both cases, both for the embalming of a person and for the ripening of a fruit. To me, this medrash was fascinating because it doesn't sound like a medrash. It sounds like something you'd see in one of the mefarshim on Chumash or something like that. You know, going into the etymology of a word. And here, this is an actual medrash that makes that connection. So it's a fascinating thing to put those two things together.
I have two more questions.
Yes. Okay.
Was it common for somebody to take their father's body and drag it through the city on their death?
Was it common for someone to take their father's body and drag it? No. Eva Meruduch was doing that because he was trying to show that his father is... He was, you know... Nebuchadnezzar was getting it back, you know, getting back everything he did.
All right. When you're talking about Yovel, you were talking about it depends if it was the territory of the first, based on Mikdash or the second. Why not the third? Because then Babel would have been included
in that section. Right. The question is the parameters of the borders of Eretz Yisrael for Yovel, what is it going to be? First base of Mikdash, second base of Mikdash, the suggestion is maybe it's the third base of Mikdash. It might be.
But then Babel would definitely.
Yeah, then that would have been included, right.
Would have had all the.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, so at that time, it's for sure the parameters would be the second base of Mikdash, because the first base of Mikdash, because that's where they were. They were in the first base of Mikdash.
Right.
The question is, today, what do you count? I don't know what we count today. We don't really know exactly where the parameters are.
That was a problem.
Right. That would be nice if we had that problem, right? Yes. Yeah. Okay. For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.